The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining this week is one of our favorite correspondents, Karen Scharf, co-chair of the Working Families Party. Welcome back, Karen.
Thanks, Alan. Happy to be here.
So you guys, the Working Families Party has been under some attack, we think, by Jay Jacobs and the governor. And some people are unkind enough to think that the governor's getting even with you for having supported a primary opponent when he ran the last time. Do you think that...
Yeah, you know, I think he's made it very clear that he, not just in relation to WFP, but in his entire tenure, that either you're with him or you're against him. And if you're not 100% with him, then he's going to come after you, even to his closest friends. Look at how he treated Mayor de Blasio in the very beginning. And now between us challenging him in a primary, which he thought, you know, shouldn't be allowed in New York State, and also having incredible successes in beating his friends in the IDC, changing the state Senate so that it would be not only majority Democratic, but majority Democratic with progressive leadership, has him, you know, very unhappy, because now, even though he won the governor's race, he's having to operate in the world that we created in the legislature.
Well, what are his chances of succeeding in beating you so that you can't vote for somebody on two different tickets?
Yeah, so it's just, you know, just to step back for one second. So this he created this Public Financing Commission, which in theory could be a very good thing, because the inordinate role of big money in New York State politics needs to be fixed. And we've, as WFP, been fighting for that for years and years and years, really since we started in 1998, and have often pushed and sometimes even tried to work with the governor to get a complete reform of our campaign finance system. Unfortunately for the governor, public financing is just a tool to get other things that he wants. And in creating the commission, he set it up so that they could also take on this question of how do the minor parties work in New York, and are they going to continue to exist, including the Working Families Party. And it's become clearer and clearer as the commission reaches the end here. Their report is due December 1st. They're saying they're going to issue it November 27th. They have a meeting of the commissioners Monday, the 25th, coming right up, where they're presumably going to take some votes on some of these final proposals. And it's become clearer and clearer as it's gone along that the governor's appointee, Jay Jacobs, who's also the chair of the State Democratic Party, main purpose in being there is to make sure that this commission, regardless of what happens on public financing, goes after the WFP and the other minor parties. And he's gone through a series of different proposals. And I just have to point out, before going through the proposals and where it stands right now, that Jay Jacobs, as the chair of the State Democratic Party, should not even be on this commission in the first place. In New York, party officials are not allowed to be on commissions, but the governor snuck into this establishment of this commission language an exception to allow party officials to be on the commission so that he could appoint Jay Jacobs, so that Jay Jacobs could play this role. So it's another whole level of the governor's advanced planning on this and what he really wanted to accomplish, because lots of people could have accomplished the goals on public financing, but he needed Jay there to go after the minor parties.
When I asked him about it, he denied everything, of course. He said, I don't think he's speaking to me these days, but he did say that he ran on your party. Therefore, this is all a lot of nonsense. He's not trying to get even with anybody.
Yeah, you've written a few good comments about this. Why do you think he's doing it?
I think he's doing it for the same reason you think he's doing it. I think he's trying to kill the WFP, which is too bad, because you guys are terrific and you're doing incredible work.
So I sort of changed the subject. You asked me about the proposals. I meant to go more than that. So originally Jay was proposing to completely ban fusion, which, as you said, it means that minor parties would not be allowed to endorse candidates at the major parties. So right now in New York, you can run on as many party lines as want to support you. And Jay's original proposal would have made it so that candidates could only have one party line, and each party would have to run different candidates, which would have forced us to basically, it would have made it illegal for us to endorse Democratic candidates, which is an odd thing for the head of the State Democratic Party to want to do. It really undermines his own candidates in pretty serious ways. But he wanted to carry out this mission to get rid of the WFP, because he knows that if we had to only run our own candidates, we most often wouldn't want to do that because we're trying to elect someone, not just be a spoiler role. So we had a lawsuit, as did the Conservative Party, saying that this was unconstitutional in New York, and the legal record on this is quite strong. The Court of Appeals has 3 times ruled that fusion is protected by the New York State Constitution. So they've now backed off of that. Presumably they finally got their legal facts straight. But now they're trying to essentially do the same thing by changing the rules for how you get to be a minor party. Right now, you get a ballot line in New York if you get 50,000 or more votes for governor, and then you have that line for 4 years, and then you have to do it again the next time there's a governor's race 4 years later. And that's one of the more difficult thresholds for becoming a party in the country, and they want to make it massively harder. And on the face of it, it's bad enough. And then the secret underlying poison pill is even worse. But on the face of it, Jay is saying 250,000. He's backing off of that a little bit because that's so crazy. But even, you know, the rumors are that they're going to propose something like 150,000 votes to qualify, 3 times what it is now. That's already quite difficult and onerous. And the most likely outcome would be the Conservative Party would survive and none of the other minor parties would. So the chair of the State Democratic Party is making it so that the Conservative Party survives to support Republicans, but we don't survive to support Democrats, which, again, is very contradictory. And that's why we've got huge opposition from state legislators and congresspeople who run on the WFP line and want to keep running on it. But even worse than that, if they've inserted this proposal, I hope the commission doesn't take it up, but we'll see on Monday, that you would have to qualify every 2 years instead of every 4 years. So in the presidential race and the gubernatorial race, which, again, bad enough that you have to do it every 2 years, and it's an expensive proposition to do, especially with a higher threshold to get those votes. But the thing that people don't really understand is that because of how the Electoral College works, this actually allows them to straight out kill the WFP. When parties nominate their candidates for president, voters actually vote for the electors, not the candidate. So in order for us to support the Democratic candidate for president in New York in 2020, the Democratic electors would have to agree to take our line. And obviously the governor and Jay Jacobs are going to tell them not to. So that's the real poison pill, where they're just going to kill the WFP straight out.
Wow, that's amazing. How many votes did the WFP get in the last gubernatorial election?
We got 114,000 last time. You know, we had although we supported Cynthia, we ended up having the governor on our line for the general election. There was not a lot of enthusiasm among our people for him. We have had some higher totals in other years and for other candidates. We did better for DiNapoli, for example, and for Tish James. But it depends on how many people vote. 2018 was a huge turnout year. If it had been a smaller turnout year, we could have been lower. And a lot of states do it by percentage of the vote cast, not by a specific number of voters, which is more reasonable considering how much voter turnout changes year to year. But the bottom line is there's no reason to change it. We already have a good party qualification system. It keeps the parties that qualify being parties that you have to have a decent enough base and resources to get to 50,000. You have to get 50,000 every 4 years to keep your line. And there's no reason to change it except the governor's revenge.
It's the Capital Connection. We're talking with Karen Scharf, co-chair of the Working Families Party. Karen, I guess I want to reference the fact that a whole lot of politicians have signed a letter telling that commission to cut it out, to behave themselves and not to basically go after the Working Families Party and to keep things the way they were, right?
That's right. I mean, that's the thing, is that ironically, where we have the chair of the State Democratic Party taking this very aggressive position, most Democratic elected officials don't agree with him. There are some who do, but most don't. We had this letter from assembly members and senators who, first of all, say this commission should do a much stronger public financing system than they're proposing, and secondly, that they should not touch the minor party rules and qualifications. And these assembly members and senators, and we've had the same letters earlier, almost the entire Democratic congressional delegation signed a letter earlier in the year basically saying the same thing. This is not in their interest, and they support the WFP generally, but they also support the democracy of having the minor parties, and they don't feel it's good for their races as Democratic candidates what Jay Jacobs is doing. And the other thing that's kind of crazy is this, you know, last week Jay Jacobs tried to justify his proposal by saying, you know, he doesn't know what the minor parties do with their money. They don't use it for campaigning like the Democrats and Republicans, so they can spend it to meet a new high threshold. And it's crazy because right now we have a clear case in point. I don't know if you've had a chance to follow the district attorney race in Ulster County, but we had an excellent Democratic candidate that the Working Families Party supported. In fact, we invested $60,000 in that race. Jay Jacobs, the chair of the State Democratic Party, ignored the campaign. On election night, our candidate was down by 3 votes. He's now in a very, long and difficult recount. And when he's asked the Democratic Party for legal support and money for legal support, Jay has said the Democratic Party has no money and can't help him. And this is a great example of where the WFP has for decades had a long commitment to helping local candidates, and we come through for them. The state Democratic Party continues to fail local Democratic candidates. And now Jay Jacobs is so busy trying to kill off the minor parties, he's not taking care of his own party and his own candidates. And if he forces us to spend all our money getting the ballot line every 2 years, we won't be in a position to help, you know, excellent Democratic candidates like David Clegg, and we won't be in a position to give them our line where they need to get those extra votes to win. And in 2020, it's going to really affect our congressional candidates. We need to, you know, 2020 couldn't be a more important election year, where not only do we have to win the presidential race, but we need to keep our protect our congressional candidates that won for the first time in 2018, like Antonio Delgado, Anthony Brindisi. And instead of working to help them, we're going to be trying to save the line in order to get whatever the new threshold is if Jay gets his way, and then also dealing with this possible completely devastating problem of will the Democratic electors take our line.
Is this a psychological fault on the part of the governor? I mean, the way you're explaining it doesn't make an awful lot of sense to me that he's basically killing his own party.
Yeah, it's just really, it's complete. I can't see any rational basis. Jay Jacobs, and, you know, the governor pretends it has nothing to do with him, but we all know that's not true. Jacobs keeps trying to defend it with different defenses, like they should be able to do it. He tries to pretend that it's going to affect the public financing system. Every expert and the experience in New York City and Connecticut have shown that the existence of fusion of minor parties has no impact on the public financing system. So every rational policy defense that they have tried to provide doesn't hold up to any expert scrutiny whatsoever. So there's no good reason, you know, from a policy or the future of the state perspective to be doing this. So it leaves really only one reason, is just the governor doesn't like what the governor doesn't control, and Jay Jacobs, for reasons I don't understand, given his role as the state party chair, wants to do what the governor wants him to do. And Jay has his own feud with the Independence Party, but, you know, that's a Nassau County issue. That's not a state issue, and he shouldn't be using a state commission to take care of his own local politics while destroying Democrats all across upstate New York. And that's what he's doing. He's destroying Democratic chances all across upstate New York.
So let me ask you this. We have a major presidential election coming. You just talked about the Electoral College and how that all works. Do you expect New York is going to play any kind of role in this at all? I mean, clearly, Trump will lose in New York.
Yep. You know, obviously, we have a role in the Democratic primary, which is going to be important. But yeah, there's no scenario I could possibly imagine where Trump won't lose in New York. So because of the Electoral College, we won't have much of an impact on whether Trump wins or loses. I think we will have an important role in making sure that our three new congresspeople who won last time get reelected. And also, hopefully, we can pick up Pete King's seat in Long Island. So four congressional races are going to be very important in New York, possibly others as well. Syracuse race, potentially. The Collins seat, potentially. So there's, you know, four to probably six congressional seats at play in New York, and that's where we can make a real contribution to the national politics in the general election. And I think that's really, you know, we should all, as people who care about the future of our country, be worried about those federal elections next year and not fighting each other. And instead, the governor and Jay Jacobs have decided to take a year where we need to defeat Republicans and instead want to defeat the Working Families Party, which has done nothing but help strong local candidates get elected, most of them Democrats, all of them great, and then also played a huge role in giving us a Democratic Senate led by progressive Democrats who are doing a great job. And yet, instead of helping us with that and working together the way that you would think the Democratic Party and the Democratic governor would want to do, they're putting their time into trying to kill us. And I think, you know, in the end, we're going to, if Jay gets the votes on the commission, which I hope he won't, he doesn't. You know, I think we have to just kind of going back to the Fed for a minute. The commission was appointed by the governor, the assembly, the Senate, and then the Republican Senate and Republican Assembly, and then a ninth commissioner. And those commissioners both individually have to make a choice, but also, you know, we would expect that the assembly and the Senate would hold their commissioners accountable for their votes. And so if this commission goes along with Jay Jacobs' proposal, that will mean that five commissioners have voted with him. And, you know, if for example, the assembly commissioners decide to vote with Jay Jacobs to kill the WFP, the poison pill of the presidential election, the WFP members are going to be very angry, and we're going to go after the people that tried to kill us. So we think it's incumbent upon the assembly and Senate to hold their commissioners to what their houses want and what their members want, and this letter shows what their members want. And the letter also said that these senators and assembly members believe if the commission does the wrong thing, they should come back in a special session in December to undo it. And they do have the power, if they come back before December 22nd, to overturn the commission. But they only have those 3 weeks to do it. So, you know, I would urge all your listeners to be in touch with their assembly members and senators and urge them to make sure that we get a good public financing system, not a bad one, and that they don't touch the minor parties.
Talk to us a little bit about Speaker Hastie's role in all of this. Does the speaker have to genuflect to Andrew Cuomo? I mean, or does he have his own power base in which he can stand up to the governor?
I was very encouraged to see during the legislative session that both the Senate and the Assembly stood up to the governor in times when it really mattered, and when their Assembly members and senators and the constituents of their Assembly members and senators had a lot at stake, they did what needed to be done. And so I think we've seen, well, the governor unfortunately has a huge amount of power in general, but especially in the state budget process because of all of the past rulings. And so they you know, when he set up this commission, he did it as part of the budget process. It was much harder for them to deal with it as part of a huge budget. But I think in general, we've seen a good track record on the part of both leaders of standing for what's right.
So I want to transfer to education. How is New York doing? You're one of the founders of the Alliance for Quality Education. Way, way back, all kinds of promises have been made about what the kids are going to get in New York. Are we in trouble?
Yep. We're totally in trouble on school funding because the state has continued to fail to fund to meet the promises that were made to fund foundation aid, which was geared toward funding our neediest school districts. And so we have school districts that are really struggling with large class sizes, with lack of basic resources, with even times when, like, not having the books and paper that they need at the most basic level, not having the resources they need, and then also at the higher levels of not having enough teachers, not having enough guidance counselors and social workers, not having enough money to have the things like art and music supplies. They just, these are the kind of things that people are losing out. The kids are losing out on because we have inadequate funding in New York. We've fought this fight for decades. The court, the highest court in New York, ruled in the Campaign for Fiscal Equity lawsuit that the state had a constitutional obligation to provide the quality education that every child deserves. The governor and the legislature came up with a new formula, enacted it, and it was designed to meet these exact needs. And the state is still about $4 billion short in every single year in funding that formula, and that the impact of that money is almost entirely on our poorest school districts in the state, mostly Black and Brown communities. So we have a state that's completely failing to meet the educational needs of its children in our poorest communities, and that's got to change. And that is one area where the Assembly and the Senate have said that they really don't agree with the governor on this and that they do want to fully fund our schools. They're going to have to figure out how to manage the budget process where the governor has so much power to change what he wants to do, and that he'll come back in with a budget again that fails to fully fund our schools, and the Assembly and Senate are going to have to figure out how to change that this year.
Surely somebody is listening to this and saying, well, Karen, you say that they're not meeting their obligations, and yet time after time we hear New York spends more money than anybody else on its education process. What's that about?
Two things on that. The biggest is the question of equity. When averages really don't mean a whole lot, you can average things and it sounds okay, but doesn't mean that it's never, no one's actually functioning in the average school district. Some people are in very rich school districts and some people are in very poor school districts. And there are some in between, but the average of what we spend per pupil is meaningless when you have a district like Scarsdale or Jericho on Long Island that can spend $35,000 per pupil, and that way ups the average compared to other districts. So the average we spend per pupil doesn't address what's happening in our poorer districts. Is the most important thing, and what we're looking for is equity as well as adequacy. And secondly, we should be spending a lot on our schools. I think this idea that it's somehow a negative that New York is spending more than other states is crazy. We have a better educational system than a lot of the southern states in particular. And as a result, we have more student success. So there's things that New York is doing right. We're not doing it equitably. It's not the Black and Brown communities in particular are not getting the education that we're getting in our wealthiest communities. And the states that are spending less than us, honestly, need to spend more.
Talk to me about incarceration. You know, I know that Working Families Party has real concerns about this, about ending mass incarceration. And now we see a federal judge has blocked the Trump administration in an attempt to revive capital punishment. But my sense of it is, Karen Scharf, that when it gets up to the Supreme Court of the United States with those conservatives sitting there on the court that will continue to have capital punishment. Am I wrong?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the many devastating long-term impacts of the Trump administration is our courts. They have been very successful in packing the courts with conservative justices, including, you know, the Supreme Court with a Kavanaugh appointment is now going to make some very bad decisions over future years. And so I do really fear for what's going to happen at the federal level with the courts. That makes it even more incumbent upon us in New York to make sure that New Yorkers are protected from the bad decisions of the Trump administration and the Trump judges, and specifically mass incarceration. We're headed in the right direction in New York, but we need to move there a lot faster. There's no reason for, it's great that we've made the major reforms that we made in the last legislative session. They need to be implemented. There's no reason to move backward. You know, the DAs are complaining and saying they can't make changes fast enough. Well, people are sitting in jail for no reason, and that's got to change right away.
What are the chances that, you know, we come back 10 years from now and look back at this time and we'll say, well, you know, this is where New York made a difference in terms of putting so many people in jail?
I think there's a good chance, but we're not there yet. You know, we have fought for and the legislature enacted major changes, especially in bail, in discovery and speedy trial. And if those changes are correctly and adequately and quickly implemented, I think we will look back and say that was a real turning point in New York, and we finally stopped having people who haven't even been tried and have not been found guilty of anything sitting in jail just because they're poor. And we need to continue, obviously, on a whole host of other changes to our criminal justice system because mass incarceration is deeply embedded. But I think, you know, if we implement these reforms quickly and well, we will look back and say this was a turning point.
Let's go to presidential politics. Mike Bloomberg is running for president. What do you make of that?
We don't need another billionaire running for president. I don't know. You know, these guys think because they have money, they're entitled to do whatever they want to do. It just doesn't work that way. I don't think that the American people or the Democratic primary voters are going to be interested in a Bloomberg candidacy. He's done some very good things with his money since he's finished being mayor, and he should keep doing that. But we don't need someone as president who's, first of all, was not a good mayor for New York City, but on top of that is only running because he's got the money too.
Well, you say he wasn't a good mayor, but he got elected three times.
He did, but he's responsible for some of the serious problems of mass incarceration we had in New York City. I mean, his stop and frisk policy, he now finally admits was wrong, but he dug deep on it, completely insisted that it was the best possible policy for New York. It's been proven now that it did not hold down crime the way he claimed it did, and it meant that thousands of black and brown people, a lot of them young people, were put in jail and were arrested needlessly and were stopped needlessly and had their lives changed because he thought this was a great policy looking down from the top. And that just shows kind of how Bloomberg operates. He thought it was a great policy. He didn't care the impact it was having on thousands of people that were being stopped every day in the streets for no reason. And then when people pointed it out to him, he just doubled down and insisted on continuing it. And so now he can come back and say, like, hey, I'm sorry, that was wrong. But what about all those thousands of people who suffered as a result of his policies?
Let's talk pot. What are the chances we're going to see it in New York? And what do you think Governor Cuomo is really up to when it comes to pot? He told me in the beginning, you know, a gateway drug. Then he changed his mind when he got the left coming on strong. But it's not getting done.
Yeah, and it's a very important piece in relationship to ending mass incarceration because low-level pot arrests have been such a big part of fueling mass incarceration and fueling stop and frisk when that was policy. And we're making some steps forward on that, but really legalization is needed as part of the reform of our criminal justice system. I think the governor, it seems like he's heading toward figuring out a way to do it. I think the questions around it all have to do with money. And if we really wanted to know what was going on, it would require following the money and figuring out who's trying to profit and how is the system, as we legalize pot, being structured so that the people that the governor wants to have benefit are going to benefit. And I think it's really important. It's, you know, the Assembly and Senate both had bills that made sure to drive both the business and the pot business and then also the revenue to the state toward the communities that have most suffered from the war on drugs, and that's crucial.
So you just made reference to doing it the right way. What is the right way?
It's definitely, to me, it has to do with both where the money goes for, you know, who's going to make, there's a huge amount of money that's going to be made off of legal pot. That's already happening in the states that have legalized. It's a huge business, and it's important to figure out who's going to benefit from that big business, from that big business opportunity. Is it going to be the people who, you know, like Boehner, who are, you know, coming in, creating national companies and trying to just make money, or is it going to be people in the communities that were most devastated by the war on drugs being able to create their own businesses and having a chance to actually have, you know, good paying jobs out of this legalization? And then there's the question of the revenue to the state, which is also substantial from pot, and where is that going to go? Is it going to get invested back in black and brown communities that have suffered from the war on drugs, or is it going to go to fill some other kind of hole in the governor's budget so that he can avoid taxing millionaires? And those are the two big questions, is who's going to profit and where does the revenue go? And doing it right means answering those in a way that's going to benefit the people of New York generally and the people who suffered from the drug war, which is mostly black and brown communities specifically, and not the wealthy and well-connected who are busy lobbying the governor, you know, endlessly about how they can make their profits and also avoid paying higher taxes.
Karen Scharf, I only have a minute and a half, but I wanted to ask you about immigration, the green light law where undocumented immigrants get driver's licenses, and some county clerks are pushing back. What do you make of it?
You know, this, some county clerks are just resistant to change and clearly racist. The green light bill is a great step forward for New York. It shows how New York can lead as our country is moving backwards, and the president is encouraging anti-immigrant feelings. New York took the exact opposite direction and said immigrants are welcome here, and we need to make it so that they can work and take care of their families and be able to drive legally. And the county clerks that are against it are going to end up losing in the long run and are on the wrong side of history.
I would agree with that. Our guest has been Karen Scharf, co-chair of the Working Families Party. Karen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Alan.